What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
On Thursday, May 29th, I got to sit down with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Chris Hedges to discuss his most recent book, A Genocide Foretold, reporting on survival and resistance in occupied Palestine. We sat down at the First Congregational Church of Oakland in a packed house of Oaklanders and surrounding Bay Area community members. The book is a firsthand account of his time on the ground from October 23 to around about December of 2024, full year of bearing witness to Israel's genocidal assault on the Palestinian people and the Palestinian people's resistance that daily inspires millions of colonized and oppressed peoples across the globe. His presentation is more than a talk. It's a gut-wrenching, heart-filled conversation with us by a human being that has spent their journalistic career watching the worst of man's inhumanity to man and humanity's refusal to go down without a fight. Here's my talk with Chris Hedges. Let's roll that tape.
You know, if resistance was a muscle, Kat Brooks would be really buff. She is the host of Law and Disorder, and she has graciously joined us this evening to talk with Chris Hedges. So, Kat Brooks.
How y'all feeling? Thank you for being here tonight. I'm not going to talk too much because I know y'all want to hear from Mr. Hedges. I do want to say really quickly the importance of truth-telling in this moment. Truth-telling is the fuel of resistance. Truth-telling is every single one of our jobs, and truth-telling is what they are terrified of. From the moment that the events of October 7th hit the media, we saw the craft of Israeli spin, and we saw the reach of the Zionist state on American media. Lie after lie, spin after spin, justification after justification, as if you could justify a genocide. But what that did do was enable a lot of our fellow Americans to look the other way, to believe the lies regurgitated by so-called left-leaning media like CNN and MSNBC, 24-hour soundbite cycles that somehow encouraged people to close their eyes and their ears as children and women and elders and human beings were bombed to smithereens, as hospitals were closed, as people have starved, atrocity after atrocity after atrocity. And now we have an administration that is actively working to shut down every single possible form, angle, pathway to dissent. The greatest thing that we can do right now is refuse to shut up and commit to truth-telling. And that's part of why tonight is so important, right? We're about to spend a couple hours in the truth, and it's going to be painful, and it's going to hurt, and we're probably going to cry. And I will spend a lot of days and hours right now sick to my stomach. But it's what we do with this truth once we walk out of here. Because you're going to be armed with knowledge and rage and passion. And my ask of you, my urging of you, is that you take it and you walk outside and you get about the business of being an accomplice, being an ally.
to liberatory struggle, that right now the loudest demand is to free, free Palestine.
Free, free Palestine.
Free, free, free Palestine. All right, let's get about the business of why we are here tonight. I have the very distinct honor and privilege of introducing Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges is the former Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times, an Arabic speaker. He spent 7 years covering the conflict between Israel and Palestine, much of that time in Gaza. He is the author of 14 books and has taught at several universities, including Columbia, Princeton, and the University of Toronto. His latest book that we're going to discuss today is A Genocide Foretold, Reporting on Survival and Resistance in Occupied Palestine. Y'all give Chris Hedges a town welcome.
Thank you. I just came back from Egypt, where I'm starting my new book with the cartoonist Joe Sacco on the genocide, where we have been interviewing Palestinians from Gaza, and I think Kat and I will talk about that. I just spent an hour sleeping on that couch because of that. My old office in Gaza is a pile of rubble. The streets around it, where I went for coffee, ordered maftoul or manakish, had a haircut, are flattened. Friends and colleagues are dead, or more often have vanished. Last heard from weeks or months ago, no doubt buried somewhere under the broken slabs of concrete. The uncounted dead in the tens, perhaps hundreds of thousands. Gaza is a wasteland of 50 million tons of rubble and debris. Rats and dogs scavenge amid the ruins and fetid pools of raw sewage. The putrid stench and contamination of decaying corpses rises from beneath the mountains of shattered concrete. Palestinians risk death from unexploded ordnance left behind after some 20 months of airstrikes, artillery barrages, missile strikes, and blasts from tank shells, as well as a variety of toxic substances, including pools of raw sewage and asbestos. Israel, supplied with billions of dollars of weapons from the United States, Germany, Italy, and the UK, created this hell, and it intends to maintain it. Hepatitis A, caused by drinking contaminated water, is rampant, as are respiratory ailments, scabies, malnutrition, and the widespread nausea and vomiting caused by eating rancid food. Nearly 500,000 people are facing starvation. Some 1.9 million people have been displaced, amounting to 90% of the population. They live in makeshift tents and camped amid slabs of concrete or the open air. Many have been forced to move over a dozen times. 9 in 10 homes have been destroyed or damaged. Apartment blocks, schools, hospitals, bakeries, mosques, universities. Israel blew up Isra University in Gaza City and the Turkish-Palestinian hospital on March 21st in controlled demolitions. Cemeteries, shops, and offices have been obliterated. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East, UNRWA, estimates that clearing Gaza of the rubble will take 15 years and cost between $40 billion and $50 billion. But any rebuilding of Gaza, Israel, and the Trump administration have decided will not be done for the Palestinians. Israeli organizations, including the far-right Nakala organization, have held conferences to prepare for Jewish colonization of Gaza once Palestinians are removed. This is the last chapter of the genocide. It is the final blood-soaked drive to push the Palestinians from Gaza. No food, no medicine, no shelter, no clean water, no electricity. Israel has turned Gaza into a Dante-esque cauldron of human misery, where Palestinians, at least 54,000 dead and 123,000 wounded, are being slaughtered in their hundreds and soon again in their thousands and tens of thousands, or they will be forced out never to return. This final chapter marks the end of Israeli lies, the lie of the two-state solution, the lie that Israel respects the laws of war that protect civilians, the lie that Israel bombs hospitals and schools only because they are used as staging areas by Hamas, the lie that Hamas uses civilians as human shields while Israel routinely forces captive Palestinians to enter potentially booby-trapped tunnels and buildings ahead of Israeli troops. The lie that Hamas or Palestine Islamic Jihad are responsible, the charge often being errant Palestinian rockets, for the destruction of hospitals, United Nations buildings, or mass Palestinian casualties. The lie that humanitarian aid to Gaza is blocked because Hamas is hijacking the trucks or smuggling weapons and war material. The lie that Israeli babies are beheaded or Palestinians carried out mass rape of Israeli women. The lie that 75% of the tens of thousands killed in Gaza were Hamas, quote-unquote, terrorists. The lie that Hamas, because it was allegedly rearming and recruiting new fighters, is responsible for the breakdown of the ceasefire agreement. Israel's naked genocidal visage is exposed. It is driving Palestinians, many facing starvation, from northern Gaza, luring them south to the border with Egypt by setting up a few poultry food stations, none designed to feed the 2.3 million desperate Palestinians, but corral them into caged military zones. It is about engineering chaos, concentration camps. Israel shot dead at least 10 people trying to get aid from the Israel and U.S.-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, and this is a familiar counterinsurgency tactic, one the U.S. used in Vietnam. It is about luring people like mice into a trap and positioning them along the Egyptian border to expel them. What comes next is mass starvation, scores of daily deaths from diseases caused by contaminated water and lack of food, bombs, missiles, shells, and bullets. Nothing will function. Bakeries, water treatment and sewage plants, hospitals, schools, aid distribution centers, or clinics. Less than half of the 53 emergency vehicles operated by the Palestine Red Crescent are functional due to fuel shortages, and soon there will be none. Israel's message is unequivocal. Gaza will be uninhabitable. Leave or die. Since March 18th, when Israel broke the ceasefire with heavy bombing, some 3,700 children under the age of 18 have been wounded and 1,300 have been killed, bringing the total during 20 months of genocide to 17,000 children dead and 34,000 wounded, around one in every 20 children in Gaza. In one 24-hour period, 400 Palestinians were killed, and this is only the start. The images from Gaza during the some 20 months of incessant Attacks were awful. But what is coming now will be worse. It will rival the most atrocious war crimes of the 20th century, including the mass starvation, wholesale slaughter, and leveling of the Warsaw Ghetto in 1943 by the Nazis. October 7th marked the dividing line between an Israeli policy that advocated the brutalization and subjugation of the Palestinians and a policy that calls for their annihilation and removal from historic Palestine. What we are witnessing is the equivalent of the moment triggered by the killing of some 200 soldiers led by George Armstrong Custer in June 1876 at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. After that humiliating defeat, Native Americans were slated to be exterminated, with the remnants forced into prisoner of war camps, later named reservations, where tens of thousands died of disease and lived under the merciless gaze of their armed occupiers while falling into a life of immiseration and despair. Expect the same for the Palestinians in Gaza, dumped, I fear, into one of the world's hellholes and forgotten. The expansion of Greater Israel, which includes the seizing of Syrian territory in the Golan Heights, southern Lebanon, Gaza, and the occupied West Bank, where some 40,000 Palestinians have been driven from their homes since October 7th, and which I expect will soon be annexed by Israel, is being cemented into place. But the genocide in Gaza is only the start. The world is breaking down under the onslaught of the climate crisis, which is triggering mass migrations, failed states, catastrophic wildfires, hurricanes, storms, flooding, and droughts. As global stability unravels, industrial violence, which is decimating the Palestinians, will become ubiquitous. Israel's annihilation of Gaza marks the end of a global order guided by international agreed-upon laws and rules, ones often violated by the U.S. in its imperial wars in Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan, but ones that were at least acknowledged as a utopian vision. The U.S. and its Western allies not only supply the weaponry to sustain the genocide, but obstruct the demand by most nations for an adherence to humanitarian law. They have carried out attacks against the only nation, Yemen, which has the courage to try to halt the genocide. The message this sends, especially to the global South, is clear. We have everything. If you try and take it away from us, we will kill you. The militarized drones, helicopter gunships, walls and barriers, checkpoints, coils of concertina wire, watchtowers, detention centers, deportations, brutality and torture, denial of entry visas, apartheid existence that comes with being undocumented, loss of individual rights, and electronic surveillance are as familiar to the desperate migrants along the Mexican border or attempting to enter Europe as they are to the Palestinians. Israel, which as Ronan Bergman notes in his book Rise and Kill First, has assassinated more people than any other country in the Western world, cynically employs the Nazi Holocaust to sanctify its hereditary victimhood and justify its settler colonial state, apartheid, campaigns of mass slaughter, and Zionist version of Lebensraum. Primo Levi, who survived Auschwitz, saw the Shoah for this reason as, and I quote, an inexhaustible source of evil, which is perpetuated as hatred in the survivors and springs up in a thousand ways against the very will of all, as a thirst for revenge, as moral breakdown, as negation, as weariness, as resignation. Genocide and mass extermination are not the exclusive domain of fascist Germany. Adolf Hitler, as Ami Cesari writes in Discourse on Colonialism, appeared exceptionally cruel only because he presided over the humiliation of the white man. But the Nazis, he writes, had simply applied colonialist procedures, which until then had been reserved exclusively for the Arabs of Algeria, the coolies of India, and the blacks of Africa. The German slaughter of the Herero and Namaqua, the Armenian genocide, the Bengal famine of 1943, then British Prime Minister Winston Churchill airily dismissed the deaths of 3 million Hindus in the famine by calling them, quote, a beastly people with a beastly religion, along with the dropping of nuclear bombs on the civilian targets of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, illustrates something fundamental about Western civilization. The moral philosophers who make up the Western canon, Immanuel Kant, Voltaire, David Hume, John Stuart Mill, and John Locke, as Nicole Fleetwood points out, excluded enslaved and exploited people, indigenous peoples, colonized people, women of all races, and the criminalized from their moral calculus. In their eyes, European whiteness alone imparted modernity, moral virtue, judgment, and freedom. This racist definition of personhood played a central role in justifying colonialism, slavery, the genocide of Native Americans, our imperial projects, and our fetish for white supremacy. So when you hear that the Western canon is an imperative, ask yourself, for whom? In America, the poet Langston Hughes said, Negroes do not have to be told what fascism is in action, we know. Its theories of Nordic supremacy and economic suppression have long been realities to us. The Nazis, when they formulated the Nuremberg Laws, modeled them on our Jim Crow era segregation and discrimination laws. Our refusal to grant citizenship to Native Americans and Filipinos, although they lived in the U.S. and U.S. territories, was copied by the German fascists to strip citizenship from Jews. Our anti-miscegenation laws, which criminalized interracial marriage, was the impetus to outlaw marriages between German, Jews, and Aryans. American jurisprudence classified anyone with 1% of black ancestry, the so-called one-drop rule, as black. The Nazis, ironically, showing more flexibility, classified anyone with 3 or more Jewish grandparents as Jewish. And fascism was quite popular in the United States in the 1920s, and the 1930s. The Ku Klux Klan, mirroring the fascist movements sweeping through Europe, experienced a huge revival in the 1920s. Nazis were embraced by American eugenicists who lauded the Nazi goal of racial purity and disseminated Nazi propaganda. Charles Lindbergh, who accepted a swastika medal from the Nazi Party in 1938, along with the evangelist Gerald Winrod's pro-Hitler defenders of the Christian faith, William Dudley Pelley's silver shirts, the initials SS were intentional, and the veteran-based khaki shirts were just a few of our openly fascist organizations. The idea that America is a defender of democracy, liberty, and human rights would come as a huge surprise to those Franz Fanon, called the wretched of the earth, who saw their democratically elected government subverted and overthrown by the United States in Panama in 1941, Syria 1949, Iran 1953, Guatemala 1954, the Congo 1960, Brazil 1964, Chile 1973, Honduras 2009, and Egypt in 2013. And this list does not include a host of other governments that, however despotic, as was the case in South Vietnam, Indonesia, or Iraq, were viewed as inimical to American interests and destroyed, in each case inflicting death and immiseration on millions. For empire is the external expression of white supremacy. The millions of victims of racist imperial projects in countries such as Mexico, China, India, the Congo, and Vietnam, for this reason, are deaf to the fatuous claims by Jews that their victimhood is unique. And so are Black, Brown, and Native Americans, because they also suffered Holocausts, but these Holocausts remain minimized or unacknowledged by their Western perpetrators. Israel embodies the ethno-nationalist state the far right in the United States and Europe dreams of creating for themselves, one that rejects political and cultural pluralism, as well as legal, diplomatic, and ethical norms. Israel is admired by these proto-fascists, including Christian nationalists, because it turns its back on humanitarian law to use indiscriminate lethal force to cleanse its society of those condemned as human contaminants. Israel is not an outlier, but expresses our darkest impulses, ones being turbocharged by the Trump administration. I covered the birth of Jewish fascism in Israel. I reported on the extremist Meir Kahana, who was barred from running for office and whose Koch party was outlawed in 1994 and declared a terrorist organization by Israel and the United States. I attended political rallies held by Benjamin Netanyahu, who received lavish funding from AIPAC and right-wing American Jews when he ran against Yitzhak Rabin, who was negotiating a peace settlement with the Palestinians. Netanyahu's supporters chanted, "Death to Rabin." They burned an effigy of Rabin dressed in a Nazi uniform. Netanyahu marched in front of a mock funeral for Rabin. And Rabin was assassinated on November 4, 1995, by a Jewish fanatic. Rabin's widow, Leah, blamed Netanyahu and his supporters for her husband's murder. Netanyahu, who first became prime minister in 1996, has spent his political career nurturing Jewish extremists, including Avigdor Lieberman, Gideon Sarar, Naftali Bennett, and others. His father, Ben Zion, who worked as an assistant to the Zionist pioneer Vladimir Jabotinsky, who Benito Mussolini referred to as a good fascist, was a leader in the Herut Party that called on the Jewish state to seize all the land of historic Palestine. And many of those who formed the Herut Party carried out terrorist attacks during the 1948 war that established the State of Israel. Albert Einstein, Hannah Arendt, Sidney Hook, and other Jewish intellectuals described the Herut Party in a statement published in the New York Times as, quote, "a political party closely akin in its organization, methods, political philosophy, and social appeal to Nazi and fascist parties." There has always been a strain of Jewish fascism within the Zionist project, mirroring the strain of fascism in American society. Unfortunately for us, the Israelis, and the Palestinians, these fascistic strains are ascendant. The left is no longer capable of overcoming the toxic ultra-nationalism that has evolved here. Zev Sternhill, a Holocaust survivor, and Israel's foremost authority on fascism, warned in 2018. The kind whose European strain almost wiped out a majority of the Jewish people. Sternhill added, "We see not just a growing Israeli fascism, but racism akin to Nazism in its early stages. The decision to obliterate Gaza has long been the dream of far-right Zionists, heirs of Kahana's movement. Jewish identity and Jewish nationalism are the Zionist versions of the Nazis' blood and soil. Jewish supremacy is sanctified by God, as is the slaughter of the Palestinians, who Netanyahu compares to the biblical Amalekites massacred by the Israelites. Euro-American settlers in the American colonies used the same biblical passage to justify the genocide against Native Americans." Enemies, usually Muslims, slated for extinction, are subhuman who embody evil. Violence and the threat of violence are the only forms of communication. Those outside the magical circle of Jewish nationalism supposedly understand. Messianic redemption will take place once the Palestinians are expelled. Jewish extremists call for the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest shrine for Muslims, built on the ruins of the Jewish Second Temple, which was destroyed in 70 CE by the Roman army, to be demolished. The mosque is to be replaced by a third Jewish temple, a move that would set the Muslim world alight. The West Bank, which the zealots call Judea and Samaria, will be formally annexed by Israel, and Israel will be governed by the religious laws imposed by the ultra-Orthodox Shas and United Torah Judaism parties, meaning Israel will become a Jewish version of Iran. There are already over 65 laws which discriminate directly or indirectly against Palestinian citizens of Israel and those living in the occupied territories. The campaign of indiscriminate killing of Palestinians in the West Bank, many by rogue Jewish militias who have been armed with 10,000 automatic weapons, along with house and school demolitions, and the seizure of remaining Palestinian land is exploding. Israel is this, at the same time, is turning on quote-unquote Jewish traitors within Israel and abroad who refuse to embrace the demented vision of the ruling Jewish fascists who denounce the genocide. The familiar enemies of fascism, journalists, human rights advocates, intellectuals, artists, feminists, liberals, the left, and pacifists are targeted. The judiciary, according to plans put forward by Netanyahu, will be neutered. Public debate will wither. Civil society and the rule of law will cease to exist, and those branded as disloyal will be deported. Israel could have exchanged the hostages held by Hamas for the thousands of Palestinians held hostage in Israeli prisons, often for decades, which is why the Israeli hostages were seized on October 8th. And there is evidence that in the chaotic fighting that took place, once Hamas militants entered Israel, the Israeli military decided to target not only Palestinian fighters, but the Israeli captives with them, killing perhaps hundreds of their own soldiers and citizens. Israel and its Western allies, James Baldwin saw, is headed towards the terrible probability that the dominant nations struggling to hold on to what they have stolen from their captives and unable to look into the mirror will precipitate a chaos throughout the world which, if it does not bring life on this planet to an end, will bring about a racial war such as the world has never seen.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.